ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Speaking Out.
We're mainly discussing land rights and economic empowerment.
Aboriginal enterprises in mining, exploration,
and energy. I'd like to talk a little bit about Indigenous constitutional recognition.
With Larissa Berendt.
It's a fresh view coming
on ABC Radio.
Archie Moore's Kith and Kin reveals itself slowly. First, the dimly lit room, a monochromatic space with a quiet intensity. Then the vast branches of a family tree growing through tens of thousands of years. Each name carefully handwritten, white chalk on the black walls and ceiling. A black reflective pool stands in the centre of the room, a moat cutting you off from the table of white documents that loom like tombstones. On the 20th of April 2024, Kith and Kin wasn't fully open to the public. It was still the preview week at the Venice Biennale, a time for journalists, judges and other officials to see each nation's offering. When a group of Yolngu artists from Arnhem Land visit, the sense of kinship sparks something special. As they make their way around the room, the sense of grief and belonging is profound. The walls speak of presence. The voids speak of absence. The water of reflection. The chalk of impermanence. This is Speaking Out. I'm Larissa Berendt. Almost a year after winning the prestigious Golden Lion Award and wrapping up its Venice Biennale showing, Archie Moore's installation, Kith and Kin, has come home. Not just to Australia, but to Brisbane, where the Biggumbull and Gamilaroi artist lives. Archie was only the second solo Indigenous artist to represent Australia at the Venice Biennale, which is often referred to as the Olympics of the art world. And his monumental offering wasn't just a breathtaking artwork. It was a memorial that reflected the themes of death in custody, kinship, family, and overarching connection. To mark Kith and Kin's homecoming, Archie joined curator Ellie Buttrose to discuss how he used archival studies to shape his message and how this research mirrored his mother's own account of history.
I guess it began with my interest in doing a family tree on the ancestry site, a genealogical site you might know of. When I was at the Sydney Biennale, I was heard about my mother having a stroke. So I was thinking about this living archive that she was that will disappear if I don't ask her any questions about her life and family. And she became a bit more open about talking about things after that, like which was an interesting change in her behaviour, as she was, both sides of my family didn't really talk about their families, so I was curious about who they were. Started looking into archives and what an archive is and what kind of archives exist. So my father was in a secret society called the Royal Antediluvian Order of Buffaloes, which apparently started as a parody of the Freemasons and doesn't exist any longer, but I tracked down the Queensland secretary of that secret society and asked him if there was an archive, and he said, yeah, there was. What's your father's name? What lodge did he go to? So I gave him that information, then he didn't respond any further after several more emails. Wanted to keep it a secret, I guess. So I'll never know. And then it's just, yeah, so the whole installation is intended to look like have the appearance of a shrine or a memorial, place for quiet reflection and contemplation about these huge issues of death in custody and about cosmological time, language, kinship, family, who we are, where we are, who. Like Indigenous people have a very extended family, which is in contrast to the Western nuclear family. So it's your uncles and aunts could be your mothers and fathers. You could have several mothers and fathers in a Aboriginal family. But also the environment itself can be part of your family, kinship, family. a mountain or a river or all living things on the planet. So that was a way to say there's a much larger family, and if we go back 3,000 to 4,000 years, we all have a common ancestor, everyone here. So we're all part of this global family, and we have a duty to care and responsibility towards each other and the environment. And in the tree is intended to look, there's a few elements that try to illustrate the scale of things. I'm illustrating this 65,000 years of inhabitation on the continent we now call Australia. So it starts off with me in the middle there, you can see on the screen. To the left is my father's lineage, his family, and my mother's family on the right, and then keeps going up to the idea of 65,000 years and beyond. There's elements of language in the representation of time as well. So at the bottom of the tree, there's family members with two or three European names. And above that, on the Indigenous side, there's singular, diminutive, kind of pet, childlike name of a full name, like Billy instead of William, Tommy instead of Thomas. So when you see that name in the record or on a death certificate, can be pretty certain it's an Aboriginal or non-white person. And above that, there's no name anymore. There's just a descriptor of a person. So it's Aboriginal male or Johnny's wife or even more derogatory terms than that, which you'll see if you look at the tree. That's the names that are in the records in the archives. And it talks about a certain time in our history. And you go back a bit further in time, you'll see these Indigenous names, singular Indigenous name. I didn't find too many in my family, just two or three. And I went far as back as a lady called Queen Susan of Welltown, who lived on a large... So Welltown was a large pastoral run in Bungunya in Queensland, but it was on her big and bold country. I think she was quite safe there. But I don't know who her parents were. I don't know who her siblings were. So I've included other people that had worked at Bungunya, Welltown, may or may not be relatives of mine. And then there's lots of other common Indigenous names and speculative names that fill out the rest of the tree. I was adhering to the phonemes that exist in Indigenous sounds, individual sounds that make up a word. So there's no V sounds. It's not a sound that was in Indigenous languages. So I've created words without them and used names that start with sounds that don't exist in English. Well, they had 60,000 years for experimentation with different sounds to use. And some, you might think some are... You know, like you'll see bimbo in there, and you might think I'm having a joke or whatever, but that's a common name for a male name. That doesn't mean no relationship to bimbo as we know it. But there's a person called Bimbo that worked in Willingobba at the Aboriginal Medical Centre that I met once as well.
And there is this, through your research, there's been this kind of interesting play between the paper archives and people as archives. Do you want to kind of speak about that?
Yeah, so on the table above the pool in the middle of the work, there's over 500 death in custody reports for coroner reports, dating from 1991 when the Royal Commission handed down its final report with its 339 recommendations on how to solve this issue. None of them have been implemented yet, so the problem continues on. So that's over 600 now, I think, this year. There's blank areas in the blank reams of paper which represent report we know existed, but we couldn't find it or didn't have access to it. And I've redacted the names out of respect for the families as well. I wanted to do that. And there's also some documents from the archives that are my family, my grandmother, just letters from the police to the protector of Aboriginals, surveilling their whereabouts, asking, are they in this town? We heard that they went to this town. Can you go there and check and ask people? Are they associating with other Aboriginal people? Because they weren't allowed to do that. Seeking permission to marry. You know, got to ask permission. Their wages going into a trust account that they had no access to or control over. And there's a document of prisoner register for a great uncle that's him on the screen now. So he accidentally killed his father in a fight at the well town. Never seen a photo of him before, so that was done through a researcher. I found that while we were working on the project. So it was amazing to see that. And I'm just thinking also about Indigenous beliefs about time, past, present and future being on the same plane and happening at the same time, the every-when idea. And also their belief that they would return and exist in the future. So I think the archive is, that's where that happens. So my uncle's appeared to me in the future from that time, but he's also in the past. And on the left is a family tree drawn by Norman Tyndale, anthropologist who had an expedition around Australia in the 30s. I interviewed my great-grandmother in Bogabilla. Turns out to be very accurate with what my mother had said and what I've seen in other documents. So it's a very Western way of constructing a family tree as well. So I wanted to have that contrasted in the work where it's very horizontal, linear, vertical lines at the bottom of the tree. But as it goes back into time and it becomes a more organic thing, and as if you're looking into the sky, as Kamilaroi people who are known astronomers believe, that's where we go when we die, pass away to the stars, and in the dark patches between the stars are where their ancestors reside.
I just want to go back because I think there's something so important that you say in such an understated way. The Tyndale map is correct because it correlates with your mother's oral history, not the other way around.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really, very important point that you make and that can be easily kind of slipped over.
Because I grew up doubting what my mother used to say. I wasn't really sure. Yeah, so after she started talking a bit more, just cross-referenced things and it matched up.
And you did quite a bit of that through your research that you had kind of started through this project. Do you want to kind of talk about the different avenues?
Yeah, so I talked about the secret society one that I had no access to, but I looked into the Department of Veteran Affairs as another archive. Got a lot of material on my father who served in World War II. He was born in 1908. It seems like a long time ago, doesn't it? But he was quite old when I was born, 62. So it's kind of interesting, this paper trail turning into a digital trail, what's available, what you can find out about a person as well.
And why people end up in the archive.
I find the Aboriginal side of the family exist in these archives because they're Aboriginal. They come under the acts and certain laws that are made about them, and that's why they're there, and that's why I can find them. And if they get an exemption from the act, they disappear at the archive. harder to trace where they go to after that.
And there's also, like, there were things that you were kind of accessing. Sometimes you were accessing the same document, but it would look different. You know, there was a kind of formal request to the state archives.
Oh, yeah.
And that some material would come redacted, but then you also got it through a cousin and it had all the unredacted information. And that's something that I think that comes through in particularly the exhibition design that was done with Kevin O'Brien. This archival material in the centre of the room alongside the coronial inquest, it's designed so that there's a reflection pool, but it's quite low, so you feel like you have to bend, but then you feel like... but it's far enough away that then you feel like you're going to fall in. And so there's this kind of physical sense of separation. And and people who have done archival research have responded to the way that that was kind
just of... just out of reach. There.
And then do you want to talk perhaps about the reflection pool while we're here?
Yeah, so the water is a common feature in shrines and memorials. Goes back to Egyptian times, where water was a property for healing and purification. So the water positions in the space, you'll see the family tree reflected in the pool, placing them next to these coroner's reports as a way to talk about that they're not just a statistic or a number. They're also human beings and people who have families, a bit of empathy and compassion for lives lost and those who have survived.
And it's that thing about family and kin is in the title and this genealogical chart or celestial chart. It's been interesting over the past couple of days as people have been coming in to preview the work, the immediacy of that here. Do you want to perhaps speak to the kind of what it means to bring the work to Brisbane?
Both sides of my Indigenous family had lived either side of the McIntyre River, which is the squiggly bit of the Queensland-New South Wales border, where the Kamilaroi meets Biggumbull country. So a lot of the names in the tree, well, most of them are from Queensland. And it's great to have a home here at Goma, bringing it home, giving it a home. It's good. Yeah.
And it's interesting, it's, I guess it's people that have come in separately, but also people who I guess we've worked alongside with for many years, like Bruce McLean and the Weatherall family and even journalists coming through.
Had people pointing out, finding how we're related in the tree.
But that's also a bit of a motivator for some of your projects, isn't it?
Yeah, I've have a bit of a hidden agenda in some work where I've put a lot of material in the work to see if someone comes forward and tells me something about my family that I don't know. I had a house show which recreated my childhood home and had all these places that my father lived that I never knew of because he had 60 years of life before I was born. He never told me about these places, but I had a lady on Instagram say, "Oh, I lived in Kulatai and my mother knows your father." Okay. So there's not many people alive that would, because they'd either be way too young or passed away already. But she was 6 years old and she had two photos of my father from 1930. That was great to get in the mail. Yeah. I'd never seen him as a young man. It's amazing.
And?
In front of his Buick with a suit on.
And it is that thing that over the course of this project you have been speaking with family members, and so by making work you're firming up those kinship connections.
Yeah, there's a first cousin who's 80 years old. I started talking to me again. Oh, well, I never met her before, but it's my father's niece. So we have like regular Sunday lunches, like once a month now.
Yeah, and
doesn't have much to tell me about my father there, but.
And shall we talk about the materials in the work?
So it's a white chalk or a Conti, an art medium on blackboard paint as a reference to my schooling, which was done on a blackboard, you know, before there were whiteboards and iPads. So what I remember is that there was nothing about Indigenous history or Indigenous people in any of the subjects that we're taught at school. That's just a way to say, talk about that. And also it can be, you know, it's a very fragile, ephemeral kind of medium as well that could be, well, if you attempt to erase it, you probably still see kind of a trace there, some evidence behind if you try to erase this history.
Do you want to talk about what that speaks to more widely?
Yeah, it's like how things are covered up in, or, you know, in the archives as well, how some things are denied. Like, I don't find the church very helpful in giving me material or asking about stuff in their archives, or whether they do have a bit of that.
And there's some holes in the tree as well.
Yes, so there's three holes in the tree that are sort of representing a major event that has disrupted this lineage, which represents maybe a viral outbreak like smallpox, a massacre that's happened, records that have been lost, damaged through environmental factors, or information that hasn't been recorded in the first place that's left out of the archive.
And you get, I mean, there's one that's quite defined, but there's others where you do get that smudging and erasing and traces of names left.
Yes.
And I think, I mean, it's also the fact that it's all done by hand as well.
Yes, I did it all by hand myself. it is my handwriting, so the muralists were copying my handwriting, and I do the actual tree of my family at the bottom.
And, you know, we talked quite a bit in the kind of planning of the work, because you had done an earlier version of this that was commissioned by Jose da Silva at UNSW Galleries and now hangs at the National Gallery of Australia, that's on panels, and it probably would have been logistically much easier for you to, but more of a burden on you to create the work on panels and then ship it to Venice and then ship it back to here, to Mianjin, and ship it to the Tate. But
yeah, well, we didn't want to have seams visible and, you know, or trying to match things up again after they've been dismantled. And I kind of like the process of writing on the wall, or, you know, that metaphor, the writing on the wall. I think it's quite meditative after a while as well. And I think it needs to be redone each time it's been shown somewhere.
There's something that's conceptually fundamental to the work, that the lines are unbroken by panels.
Yeah.
It's that power, and the power of the person has been in the space writing this work, not in another space.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. Kind of comes across. And there's one element we haven't spoken about, and it's kind of hard to understand when we're looking at JPEGs on screens, but is the light. That was a really important part of the project.
So it's very low lighting. I had an idea that because it's low lighting and you're probably coming from a brightly lit space into a darker space, that you would need like 5 minutes in there for your eyes to adjust. So keeping you in there more than the, I don't know, what's the average, 30 seconds or something, you're looking at an artwork. So like after 5 minutes, it kind of sort of pops out of the wall. And you start to see that there's words, you might be able to read the words more than when you first came in. And Kevin O'Brien had an idea of having in Venice the next, in the vestibule area, having a colour painted that was in between the white and black. So you give your eyes time to adjust, to be not such of a big, harsh transition from light to dark.
I mean, I think there's a kind of understated metaphor in the way that that works, that often now people kind of demand information, demand things to be kind of presented to them. But this work, you have to do the work in order to see it. Mm-hmm. And you have to put in the time and you have to put in the effort, and it will come to you and you will learn from it if you just sit quietly in the space and listen and look.
Yes, that's was the intention, to sit in there and spend time in the work, which we have seen people do when we're in Venice. They kind of stop in their tracks and walk a lot slower and be very respectful of the space, which, yeah.
And much of the work is down to the millimetre exactly the same as in Venice, but there is a kind of major difference. There's no view to the canal, but there's a different move here.
Yeah, so we've got a window to the sky. Like, the idea with the in Venice was to see the canal outside, which runs alongside the Australia Pavilion. And that water in that canal goes to the Venice Lagoon and travels to the Adriatic Sea, then flows to the rest of the world, including the Brisbane River here, as a way to show we're all connected on Earth. When I get asked to do a show at a place I may not have shown before, I like to look into that site a bit and try and look at the history of what's happened there, and try and find an Aboriginal or an Australian connection to that site. So I was doing that in Venice as well. But the canal and the water works that way, as does the sky here. We're all living under the same sky. But there's also another connection in the tree. There's like one Italian name, and the Italian, Venetian and Italian people over there really loved seeing that name in the tree. That was a way of connecting them to my family, and the name was Los Chiavo, which they told me was meant the slave, and they were people from southern Italy near Sicily, I think. Yeah. And there's another person in the tree with the Venice as a middle name. Two connections.
One thing I think we skipped over because we went straight from you to cosmological time is actually the father's side of your family. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? Because I think it's a kind of a very quick, interesting metaphor for the way that your family is also the history of Australia.
Yeah, another thing I was trying to work out with the family tree, I was trying to work out how I got here. Where did we come from? My family's come from. So I found the first William Moore that arrives in Australia was caught stealing corduroy and some other materials in London, and as a teenager, and got sentenced to death and then commuted to transportation to Australia and ended up in Wollumbi in New South Wales. But my father's father, you know, got this huge chunk of land in Coolatai, New South Wales, near Inverell, in a land ballot. So they, you know, they give this land away to someone. You had to prove that you could make it economically viable with sheep or wheat or something. But that land is on the western edge of the Kamilaroi Nation, which is part of my mother's lineage. So he's getting this land for free that's been taken at some stage. And they're interesting also that they came from... Those families came from the same area in New South Wales, and my father and my mother meet in Queensland.
You know, I think that, again, speaks to this idea of time and connection, which repeats in very different ways in the project, whether it's in your own family, whether it's cosmological time, whether it's also the fact that you include your family archival material alongside the coronial inquest into police deaths in custody of First Nations people. It's showing this, that things are always interconnected and always across time.
Thank you.
That was Archie Moore talking about his award-winning work, Kith and Kin. His experiences tracing his family history through archives and coronial records gives a confronting snapshot of the impact colonisation has had on Aboriginal families and demonstrates the reparative power of using archives for personal truth-telling. For me, this is an evocative tension between the impacts of colonisation and the resilience of Aboriginal people and their communities in navigating that and remaining strong in their culture. I found the space overwhelming, and many other Blackfellas were looking to see if they could find links to Archie through his family tree. I found a connection through his Gamilaroi ancestors, layering my personal response to the work. I delved into the themes that came out of Moore's art with journalist David Marr and poet and writer Cheryl Levy over Kith and Kin's opening weekend in Brisbane. So I'd like to begin by asking you both, I know you've been through the exhibition through Kith and Kin, and I wonder if we could start maybe just by sharing what your personal response was to the work. And I'll start with you, Cheryl.
I'm not really one for hyperbole, but Archie's work has to be one of the most resolved works I've ever seen made. It communicates incredibly clearly to anyone who looks at it, but also especially to us, to Blackfellas. And the experience that Larissa and I had of finding ourselves reflected in the work, either through shared family names, first names and last names. There are some names which are, of course, mostly Old English names, like Florence, Queenie, Jack, Billy. Every Black family has a number of these people named in this way in their family. And in a way, it invites us in and achieves what something of a memorial nature is designed to achieve, to ask us to visit with our emotional reaction to the content, our emotional reaction to history, which I think is a timely reckoning for all Australians.
It's very powerful in terms of how it speaks to a First Nations audience. And I could see myself, as you mentioned up there, in the names, Flick, Walford, Lavinia, but also it with the part of the installation that is the sort of memorial to deaths in custody. I have a cousin, Lloyd Boney, who was one of the deaths that was investigated as part of the Royal Commission. So I felt like it is a reflection of something that I think has been, for me, as someone who's been a long admirer of Archie's work, the way that he brings in the sense of resilience and self-determination, expression of sovereignty through the power and the resilience of our family tree, but never ignores the impacts of colonisation that we've resisted. And that second bit makes the first bit all the more powerful. It's very easy. It was wonderful to see so many other Blackfellas looking at the wall and engaging. Mm. So, David, this is a great time to bring you in because obviously we're speaking from that First Nations perspective. Mm. From your perspective, what were your reflections? How did the installation make you feel? And what did you think about?
Well, of course, we've all seen photographs of the installation for months and months and months from Venice. And I kind of thought I knew what it would be like to walk into that room. But it wasn't what I had expected, because to be there in the room, I mean, it's awesome. It's so enormous. It's so detailed. It makes me, anyway, feel very small. It made me think what accidents we all are. Look at all that DNA on the wall, and somehow there we are, strolling around, trying not to trip into the black water. I was very privileged a few minutes ago to see somebody fall into the black water. And to see that the attendants had a whole pile of towels on hand for exactly that purpose. And I find that table of white documents staring up at those black walls enigmatic. And I think for me, what they mean are two truths facing each other. I take the walls to be true, and I take the documents to be various attempts to understand that truth. But it also, for me, is something about family trees and how family trees have become images of horror. When I was a little boy, and for most of my growing up, and indeed for a great stretch of my life, white people drew up family trees to try to claim distinguished connection to somebody. My grandmother was a Wedgwood. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, she was a Wedgwood. And it meant an enormous amount to her that she was a Wedgwood. And in the course of working on Killing for Country, I finally worked out the connection. She was not, and I am not, alas, a descendant of Josiah Wedgwood. No part of the Wedgwood fortune has come to me. We are the direct descendants of a Mr. Wedgwood who was the station master at Birmingham Station. And when I started work on Killing for Country, my wonderful editor said, "Oh, David, David, avoid the cloven hoof of family history." And what he was talking about was this kind of basic white Australian notion that family trees are there to connect you to distinction. But family trees have now changed. They are there to connect us to our own country. They are there to connect us to horrors, and they're there to connect us to mysteries. And to stand in that room and see that immense family tree made me realise that we have a new symbol now for obligation and for truth, which is the family tree.
Thank you. Cheryl, your poetry often revitalises endangered Kuma language, and you describe writing as a form of activism.
Indeed.
Amongst many other things, it's a form of assertion of sovereignty, decolonisation. It's a powerful act. And what you're doing is ensuring that young people grow up seeing their culture in literature. One of the things that's really striking about Kith and Kin is the way in which it seeks to trace ancestry back to 65,000 years. So it's speaking not just to the past, but it's speaking to us and to our future generations. And that interest in both the past, the present and the future seems to be something that's very strong through your work. And I wondered if you can talk to us a little bit about the way you see language as a tool of activism and how you see it connecting our ancestors with our generations yet to come.
Well, it immediately takes me to the definition of sovereignty. Sovereignty, much like native title, is a bundle of rights that the sovereign holds. They hold rights to resources, or they assume that they have rights to resources. They have the right to designate the national language, religion, so spiritual practice. And language is one of the core pillars of sovereignty. You can dispossess a people of almost the entirety of their belief system, their way of being in the world, through dispossessing them of their language. And this is done both structurally by making it illegal or punishable, literally being flogged for speaking your language. And it's also done through the practice of what was almost a hobbyist activity that has now become a science, recording languages, linguistics. For example, with the Kuma language, which is considered critically endangered, indeed only one person, who I'm pretty sure was me, but I don't like to claim it because it could have been someone else. I'm not sure how reliable censuses are, was recorded as speaking the Kuma language in the last census. So it's very difficult to learn that language unless it has been recorded appropriately. For example, in the very small, I would call it booklet, word list, there is but one word for a tree. And it beggars belief that the Kuma people had only one word for trees. Like any group of people, we would have differentiated between the vast number of trees. So just on that one subject alone, the way that the language was recorded has stripped cultural knowledge, because inside of language is embedded a lot of information about a thing, especially the way that First Nations people use language in an incredibly poetic way. I think as Archie has invited us to do, we need to get up close and personal with this. We need to get emotional about this. Imagine what you need to do to a people to take the very language out of their mouths, for there to be huge holes in family trees, as Archie has quite literally and metaphorically rendered so beautifully, with the some of those holes being quite clear-cut at the edge and others having three-dimensionality. And it invites you into those holes. What's behind them? And for me, on the one hand, there is the everywhen, and on the other hand, there is nothing behind there. It has been stolen from us. So revitalization, regeneration is critically important. You can walk into that space, which could have been very confronting and painful to stand in, and somehow it does this balance of truth-telling and allowing you to access your own emotional response. And for me, at least, the chief one was empathy.
David, I mentioned that one of the things that I really respond to in Archie's work, and Kith and Kin has this element to it too, is that it balances the idea of resilience and perhaps centres it against the impacts of colonisation and those parts of our history. He does it very powerfully. One of the things that I really liked about your book, Killing for Country, was apart from the fact that you talk about what you've discovered in terms of your own family's complicity in dispossession, you don't shy away from it, but nor do you take what would have been described as a black armband view. You're very frank about this being the history. And I thought, as a reader, a First Nations reader, I appreciated that you weren't doing a lot of hand-wringing with it. You were treating me like an adult who knew this history was there, and in a way you were confirming it. But I also liked the way that you concluded the book by observing, I guess, and reflecting on what it would mean for non-Indigenous Australians to recognise that history more openly. And I wonder if you could share those reflections with us here, because I think they're a very interesting conversation that needs to be had.
I'm so pleased that you responded to the tone of the book in that way, because I think the tone of a history of this kind really matters. Not least because there are hundreds and hundreds of pages of massacres in the book and you've got to get through them. And that can't be done by raging, by weeping. It has to be done coolly as a historical project. And that was uppermost in my mind as an approach. It's an approach I've taken in other books as well, where I've been describing, I seem to have a habit of writing books about hideous things. Well, some glorious things. Oh, Patrick White was glorious. So Garfield Barwick, hideous. People arriving by boat, hideous, etc. But the tone, I think, is extraordinarily important. But the tone also goes to the notion that at the end of this horrible process, there remains an Indigenous people in Australia, and that they are not hopelessly crippled, that they are not, they are part of us, enlivening us, and God knows, showing us what this country is really like. And that's still going on, and in fact, more powerfully than ever. I also think that my book is part of now a 40-year project of telling the truth about Australia's past. Now, the truth has been told about Australia's past often. Oddly enough, it's very, very clearly there in the fiction of the early 20th century, even when it's not there in the histories written in the early 20th century. But there's also something which I think we need to think about really carefully. And it only came to me quite recently. We are told about the great forgetting. And yes, there has been a great forgetting. But we never forgot Van Diemen's Land. We always knew about the massacres in Van Diemen's Land. And that the forgetting has a subtle aspect to it. What we forgot was what happened on the mainland. While still, I was taught about Van Diemen's Land, Tasmania, as it unfortunately became. It's a bit of a passion of mine about the change of name. I was taught about that at school. I was taught about the great massacres down there when I was at school.
If I can interject, it's because it was imagined to be complete. It was being celebrated.
Right. Well, no, that's... I
feel it was being celebrated myself.
Well, I don't. I mean, it was what happened in that island colony is part of the definition of genocide, when you go to the fundamental documents about the evolution of the notion of genocide, that is there because it was assumed they had all been killed. But thankfully, they had not. But the forgetting is the forgetting of what happened on the mainland. And the forgetting was profound. But for 40 years now, the history has been written. And those people who are whinging about the black armband history are simply not listened to anymore in the literary world. Alas, they are being listened to in the political world, where those people won the debate over the voice. They won it, to my mind, profoundly disgusting way. I could listen to the arguments that Peter Dutton and Nampajimpa Price and others were advancing during the referendum debate, and I can point you to the same arguments in slightly different language in the newspapers of the colony in 1835. They're the same arguments.
That indeed is true, and I think words like forgetting are part of it. The word forgetting for me implies a lack of agency. It's the deliberate obscuring and removing from the record and the positioning, the tone of the story that is told by the victors that I think is very much part of the colonial project, the ongoing colonial project. And as you've mentioned, you see it writ large over the last, let's give it a decade, but I can't remember a point in time in my own life when I became conscious of these sorts of things, perhaps from about the time of being a young teenager, that it hasn't been writ large in the media. It is an ongoing project to continue to practice one of those elements of sovereignty, as I referenced at the beginning of this conversation, which is being the puppet master of the public conversation.
I want to look to the future. As I said, I think one of the really wonderful things that Archie's achieved with Kith and Kin is drawing us back to how deep our history is and our connections to people and country. And I loved being able to be in there and to feel like it was almost a living family tree. You're a part of it. You can see where the other people in your life sit in relation to it. And I just wonder then, in terms of thinking about what it would mean for taking those ideas into the future. And I'll start with you, David. What are your reflections? And I guess picking up on some of the themes that Archie tries to explore in the work, of where you think we need to be aspiring to be, the conversations we should be having, if we're to have perhaps a stronger sense of truth-telling, a stronger democracy, a stronger sense of our relationship between our Aboriginal history and our non-Aboriginal history.
Well, I think one of the really powerful things for me of walking into that room is that we are all one. It's all white chalk on a black wall. It's not as though the Indigenous are over there and the Scots are over here and the Irish are down there. We are all one in that room and confronted with those walls and with the documents on that table. We are all one. And I love the way in which the family tree turns into, at first it seems to me, a cloud, and then it turns into the stars. Down here, we're just down here, and Archie has got himself there as me, you know, just this tiny little thing as me. But when you see that me, you think, yeah, it's me too.
I wonder if you can share what your reflections are, thinking about the themes of Kith and Kin and what you would anticipate would be a kind of hope for the future.
I want to invite people into something that maybe is a little bit less obvious, but it's right there in front of you. The introduction, for me at least, of the element of water and the celestial invites us into relationship with country. It reminds us that we are part of one living universe. So on that subject matter, we agree. We are part of one living universe. And I also agree with you around the placement of me. Because of the nature, our human nature, we imagine ourselves as me too. And therefore, we're invited to remember what we willfully forget, and that we are aided to forget by the nature of Western society, which is that we are part of one living universe and we are all connected. And in that way, it's also a climate and an environmental, political piece of work as much as it is about family and kith and kin. So in the future, I hope that we can have an actual reckoning that results in real change.
If you had some general reflections on, in this day and age, the power and importance of art in terms of our politics. And I'll start with you, David.
What a mighty, fabulous subject, because Indigenous Australia has come to dominate art in this country. And the voice and the power of the Indigenous voice through art is unstoppable and has to be heard and has to be profoundly respected, which is showing to white fellas like me what this country is and what the past of it is. And art has that power, but art has a way of just undermining all of our defences.
I feel that First Nations epistemology, the way that we teach, share information, our ontology, our very way of being in the world is art. It is an art form. All of our art forms are fully integrated into our spiritual belief system, the way that we relate to each other, the way that we look after country, our connection to country. It's a fully integrated system, which is why First Nations art carries so much power and can reach all the way into the hearts and minds of people with whom we almost have nothing in common, let alone with fellow Australians. It has captured the hearts and minds of people around the world. There is a deep beauty, which is not just aesthetic. It's a beauty that makes us feel something that is deeply embedded in First Nations arts practices of all forms. There's an extraordinary power in helping us to remember that the thing that differentiates us from every other animal on this planet, that we are not supreme over. We should not be practicing supremacy over any living thing, let alone each other, is that we have the capacity to feel with such nuance, and we need to do that a whole lot more. And I think Archie's work is going to do that well beyond this generation of viewers.
Thanking our panellists, David Maher and Cheryl Levy, and of course, Archie Moore, whose vision has brought us together in this space for reflection. That was journalist David Maher and poet and writer Cheryl Levy. They were speaking to me at Quagoma for the opening weekend of Archie Moore's award-winning work, Kith and Kin. The installation is on at Quagoma in Brisbane now until the 18th of October, 2026. That's the show for now. Join us again next time for more stories from across Indigenous Australia. Speaking Out is produced by Janaea Gibbs-Muir and Nadine Haynes. Our senior producer is Jay McAllister. And as always, you can find us on the ABC Listen app or on social media via ABC Indigenous, along with our Titter show Away, hosted by Rudy Bremer. This week, she's marking 40 years since Uluru was handed back to its traditional owners. I'm Larissa Berendt, and this is Speaking Out.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.